Welcome to Indie Media On Air. This is Chris Burnett, and I am joined on the phone from Chiapas with Raymer Ryan, author of Clandestines, The Pirate Journals of an Irish Exile. And I want to let the audience know that this book is been published recently by AK Press. And Raymer, welcome to Indie Media On Air.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here, actually, and I want to say that I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book. I couldn't put it down, and it was, in so many ways, it was just an inspiration to read, and I hope that you can keep writing in the future, but I'm really glad to have you here to talk about what you were writing about.
Well, thanks very much.
Yeah. Well, I want to start off with just a quote about the book to give people an idea. You write, Clandestines began its life as a radical political tract that would graph the trajectory of resistance movements from anti-imperialism to anti-capitalism, starting with the anti-imperialist struggles for national liberation, Ireland, Kurdistan, Nicaragua. It was to critique the shortcomings of these movements from an anti-authoritarian position by taking inspiration from the formative years of the autonomous movement in Europe, squatting in Berlin, and reading of anarchism. The book was to plot the emergence of the new movement against capitalist globalization. The pivotal moment was to be the Zapatista uprising of 1994, which inspired so many with its participatory democracy and new formulation of revolutionary politics, a renewal of global struggle and resistance. And I think this is a really good place to start talking, because you're in Chiapas right now, and Mexico is on sort of a moment that could go either way, as we were talking earlier. What's happening now?
Well, it's a really dramatic moment in Mexico, and here I am in San Cristobal. It's the stormy season. There's a storm gathering overhead, and at the moment, there's tens of thousands of people gathering in Mexico City to lay siege on Congress as President Fox delivers his annual State of the Nation address. This is his last one. He's leaving his post in a few weeks' time. And on one hand, you've got a siege on Congress by supporters of the opposition leader, Andres Lopez Obrador. And on the other hand, you've got a situation in Oaxaca, in the south of Mexico, where there's been 3 months of an uprising that's lasted 3 months. And it's now calling itself the Oaxaca Commune. And it's calling for the overthrow of the governor of the state, and it could go either way because the police forces are mustering outside the town, and the demands of the protesters are getting more radical. They're organized around a council called APO, which is the Oaxacan People's Popular Assembly, and it's a crucial moment. So here in Chiapas, it's quite quiet because the Zapatista leader, Subcomandante Marcos, has gone to Mexico City, and people are just waiting very expectantly. It's very telling times here in Mexico.
And what's your impression of what's going to happen? Do you think?
As I say, it could go either way. There could be massive repression, as we saw last May in a small town called Atenco outside Mexico City, where pro-Zapatista community rose up against police brutality, police harassment, and chased the authorities out of the small town. In response, there was a massive police operation, and in the ensuing days, there was, and this was all captured on state television and everything, there was really, really heavy repression, where hundreds of people were detained, beaten up, locked up. There was denunciations of rape from a couple of dozen women, and the police just went to town on the people there, destroying the growing consensus in that town to support the Zapatista initiative. So the fear is that the Atenco solution will be applied to Oaxaca and will be applied to the demonstrators in Mexico City as well. And indeed down here in Chiapas, where there's always this boiling rebellion from the communities, from the indigenous communities. So it could go either way. The big fear is that the new president, Calderon, from the PAN party, who's going to be elected in a couple of months, is a real right-winger, even more right-wing than Fox. So that's the threat there is that he already called the Atenco brutality the right thing, and he applauded the police for that. So his response to Mexico in turmoil, and some people are calling it the new 1968, some people are calling it the new Mexican Revolution, but his response is going to be the iron fist. So the worry is, of course, you know, how do you deal with, what level of self-defense will the people use against the police onslaught?
Well, it's not surprising that this is the situation has come to this. But it's so inspiring to see the level of participation amongst the people, and getting mobilized, and especially Oaxaca.
Oaxaca has been huge. I mean, there's been 120,000 people in marches. Now, Oaxaca is a really big place. For instance, it's bigger than Ireland. It's got a greater population than Ireland, my country. And it's a pretty important state as well, you know, because it's kind of hinged there between the north and the south. And it's always been a hotbed of rebellion and radical politics. Now, all these forces are finally coming together in this one movement. As I say, they're organized around this People's Council called APO, in its Spanish initials. And this amalgamation of forces is making it possibly the biggest revolutionary movement in Mexico since 1968. Certainly it's much greater than the Zapatistas. Although, of course, in 2001, the Zapatistas were mobilizing hundreds of thousands as they went around Mexico City on their caravan. The thing about Oaxaca is that it comes from a long tradition of rebellion and radical politics, and it's the radicalism as well as the sheer numbers that's really inspiring for me at the moment.
Well, this is a great place to depart and talk about your book, and we can come back to more about Mexico. And if we go back in time to the beginning of your book, which is around 1989-1990, you talk about your beginnings politically, and there was an incident that happened in Ireland at a funeral. Can you just briefly talk about how that affected you and started you on your trajectory of, you know, being involved in movements and covering them and being a part of them?
Well, what you're talking about is a chapter in the book called The Making of a Rebel, where I was a young teenager living in Dublin in the 80s, which was a very depressed place. 20% unemployment, emigration was a rite of passage, and there was no options. You know, if you were an 18-year-old in Dublin, you left. There was no jobs, there was no possibilities. And of course, there was a raging war going on up north as the IRA were fighting the pro-British forces, the British occupation. Now, even though Dublin's only 60 miles from the north, from the border, it's still a world away. And it's relatively unscathed by the war, as we called it. And certainly, there was no, you know, there was none of the bombs or the military presence that there was up north. So day-to-day life in Dublin wasn't affected. So you could live a completely insulated life down in Dublin in the south of Ireland and not be affected by the war. So, I mean, to get involved, you had to go up there and see for yourself what was going on. So the occasion for our visit was three IRA volunteers had been shot down in the British Protectorate of Gibraltar off the coast of Spain. In cold blood, killed by the British Army, the SAS, which is kind of like the green berets of the British Army, shot down in the street as they were walking along on a sunny day. So pretty, I mean, they were IRA people, and they were there to do an action, but the manner of the execution was very, you know, I mean, this is meant to be a parliamentary democracy and everything, and the state are just out killing people in the street. So we were like, well, what's going on there? Let's go and sort it out. So myself and my friend, we went up north to Belfast to attend this funeral. It was a big funeral. Maybe 10,000 people were out there. And in the middle of the funeral, he got attacked by a pro-British agent, this paramilitary, who arrived, ran up through the gravestones of the graveyard and started throwing grenades and opening up with a machine gun on the assembled, who were like, right at that very moment, you know, lowering the coffins into the ground. So all hell broke loose, and a lot of people were hurt. 3 people were killed. But what happened was, we didn't know what was going on. We thought it was an attack from the sky, from the British Army, something like that, mortars. But suddenly, all these youths, Belfast youth, young Republicans, broke away and started running in one direction. And myself and my friend, we looked at each other and said, are they crazy? What are they doing? You know, they're heading towards this machine gun fire and grenades, and they're unarmed, and what, are they completely insane? But there was also something unbelievable what they were doing. This courage and this, like, resilience and this strength. And they headed towards this guy who they'd located and just ran at him while he shot his gun and threw his grenades and eventually caught up with him. So anyhow, we're left up on the top of the hill at the gravesite, and there's about 60 people injured, so we're like forming spontaneous chains to carry the people to the road, to commander cars to take them away to the hospital. There's dead bodies lying around. It's an appalling scene. And I'm just this kid. I'm just like 18-year-old, just up from Dublin. And it was an incredible moment for me, and I suddenly realized, you know, that there's this struggle for life and death going on my doorstep. And I wasn't even aware, you know, I didn't even make myself aware. And so the moment changed me. And I looked around me, and I opened up my eyes, and I began to see, okay, we live in this world of conflict, and where do I start? What am I going to do? So that's where I kind of began.
You know, it's just one story of many in this book that's very inspiring in that way. And I want to let people know that, you know, obviously we can't talk about the whole book, but the range of places that you've been is impressive. Mm-hmm. You, from Germany to Kurdistan, you went to a rainbow gathering in, where was that? In
Croatia,
Chiapas, Nicaragua, Cuba, yeah. Venezuela, Brazil, and... And your chicken bus diaries, which was amazing. I love that. But, you know, one thing that really struck me was that in many of these places, you were able to sort of look through the lens of a sort of anti-authoritarian perspective, or, you know, sort of an anarchist sort of, you know, political viewpoint. But you didn't get bogged down in sort of rigid ideological positions, but you found yourself having to deal with the real world and ordinary people who were struggling just to survive. But you sort of dealt an even hand to all the situations that you were in, but you managed to have a critique that was what I find, you know, inspiring and impressive, that you came out the other end, you know, recognizing sort of ordinary people and their struggle, and you also found something that I think maybe you were surprised by at times, which was the ability for these people to continue to resist.
Right.
And I think in the intro by Eddie Yoon, is that how you say his name? He acknowledges that he says. He says, the stories are a testimony to the thriving anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, and broadly anarchist milieu which has flourished in the global north and Latin America in the last few decades. Not to say that all the characters encountered in these pages are self-consciously ideological in all of their actions. In fact, it is precisely your discovery that so many quote-unquote ordinary people around the world are reinventing solidarity and mutual aid that is one of the book's most hopeful observations. And why don't we talk about a few of those examples? In Nicaragua, you visited one of the communities in the north of the country. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, once you leave, you know, you mentioned that I traveled a lot, right? So at a very early age, I made a conscious choice not to get a job, not to join the rat race as such, you know. And I said, you know, I'm taking off. This is not for me. For other people, it's not for me. And then as soon as you take off and you leave the fairly cloistered society that we live in, you know, say in Europe or in the US, and you begin to travel and it opens your eyes and you see the other world. And for these people, you know, whether it's in Nicaragua or Chiapas, or it's not a, you know, to struggle, to resist, is not a choice. It's the only option. It's not a choice. We have the choice. We can either engage in the rich societies we live in and reap the benefits, or we can rebel. Now, in these places that I started traveling around, there was no option. So the whole paradigm was very different. And so the question was not, you know, to rebel or not to rebel, but it was how to rebel. And that's why, you know, the interest in anti-authoritarian politics against Leninist authoritarian politics began to become the really crucial question, especially in Latin America, with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union. So, in terms of Nicaragua, where were we in that question?
Well, maybe, you know, an example of that experience with these people who are struggling, that you answered it. You know, they don't have a choice. This is not an option for them.
Yeah.
And yet they were able to maintain that struggle under the most horrendous conditions and the terrorist war that was sponsored and paid for by the United States government.
Yeah. And the destruction of Nicaragua was heartbreaking. It's only, you know, as the U.S. forces just pummeled the Sandinista revolution, supporting these contra-mercenaries and destroying the economy, you know, an attack on the bloodlines of the revolution, the health clinics, the education facilities, you know, they're being bombed, they're being destroyed, sabotaged. So a huge concerted effort was made by U.S. and its right-wing forces within the region in Honduras and Costa Rica to destroy the threat of a good example, which was Sandinista Nicaragua. But there was also another narrative going on, and that was the Sandinistas, the Frente Sandinista itself. It was an authoritarian, top-down organization, revolutionary guerrilla organization, who became the government. But they never stopped being guerrillas. They never stopped that kind of military structure, and they continued with that authoritarian line. So they were up there, the small group, the small cadre, 12 comandantes, deciding what was going to happen for 10 years of revolution from 79 to 89. And I saw this on the ground. I was working with the poorest of the poor, picking coffee, just living in their community, a ragged community that didn't have electricity or running water. And they adored the Sandinistas. They were fully supportive of the revolution. But they didn't have a say. There wasn't any type of participatory democracy in the revolution. There was a little on a local level. But, you know, you could see 10 years later in Chiapas, how the Zapatistas would make a conscious effort to include everybody in the decision-making process. This didn't occur at all in Nicaragua. And when power corrupted the leaders, which happened in a horrible way in the 1990s, a lot of the base said, well, we don't agree with what's going on, and we don't agree with this abuse of power. And they started forming autonomous political structures in the barrios and in the countryside. And the autonomous movement was born in Nicaragua in the early 90s. This was an incredible movement. It was small, and it had no resources, and it was anti-authoritarian, based on horizontal organizing. And it didn't survive because the economic situation in the country was so severe, so devastating, that it was destroyed by people migrating, by just the needs of just trying to survive. So this was, and then the response of the Sandinista leadership to the autonomous movement in the early 90s, well, was to try and crush it. Was, you know, a typical Leninist response, which is like, they're not following orders, they're not doing what we tell them, they're Sandinistas, but they're like rebelling against central authority, so we're gonna kick them out of the movement. So this sort of stuff I was seeing, I was understanding, and I was saying, you know, I mean, this kind of authoritarian politics is just not working. And it didn't, you know, it doesn't feel right, and it's not helping the people at the base. It's consolidating power instead. So when the Zapatistas rose up in 1994, it was like all our Christmases had come at once. You know, it was an amazing thing. It was this anti-authoritarian group who Shall we move on to the Zapatistas now? Or do you wanna...
No, no, that's perfect. Let me take this moment, actually, to identify you. I'm speaking with Raymer Ryan, author of Clandestines, the Pirate Journals of an Irish Exile, published by AK Press. And you are listening to Indie Media On Air on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the internet at kpfk.org. So Raymer, yeah, let's talk about the Zapatistas and what that meant to you, and also what do you think it spawned after the birth of the Zapatista movement in all over the world?
Well,
it was
very interesting. I was really excited about the uprising when it happened in 1994. I was in Dublin at the time. I was unemployed, which of course means like organizing in the fringes, but not working officially. So I couldn't get here. I'd love to have come here immediately. I didn't get here for another till 1995. But I thought, this is it, you know. If there's going to be a resurgence, a renewal of revolutionary struggle for the 21st century, it's beginning here. And it did. The Zapatista idea, the inspiration of Zapatistas has spread across the whole world, and the result of that small action in 94, huge action really, but a small action on the global scale, has had reverberations throughout people and countries resisting all over the world. Even today, it's ironic. You know, it looks like because of this huge situation in Oaxaca, that the Battle of Chiapas will actually be fought in Oaxaca. The Battle of Oaxaca will actually be the crucial defining moment for Mexico since 1994. And that's really interesting. But it's also an example of how the ideas spread and how it's like contagious. And the Zapatistas have been going out about the country. And this is the result. You know, people are really politicized. They're really conscious. And, of course, that's not to say that Oaxacans aren't just like Zapatistas in another state. They're completely indigenous to Oaxaca, and they've got their own political ideas. But, you know, there's this coming together of the different political philosophies in different regions, and the result is the same, this massive uprising, this resistance.
As somebody who comes from an anti-authoritarian perspective and has been, you know, directly involved in these struggles and in the people's lives and living in these communities, do you think over the last 10, 20 years that this movement of ideas and people can actually challenge the power of a centralized state in a way that can move us forward to a different place?
You know, I think these are early days yet. And I think the decline of communism, followed by the Berlin Wall, the Soviet system, devastated the left and, you know, the progressive forces as such. So, you know, it's taking time to rebuild and reconstruct an idea, a vision of how another world can be built, an anti-capitalist world against, you know, the current state of things. And at the moment, you know, in terms of this anarchist milieu, this small little subsect that exists all over the world, but very, you know, marginalized, no, it can't really affect great change. It has an influence. And as you were talking about in Seattle in 99, it looked like it could really take off in the world stage. But then it got superseded by this whole war on terror and war on, you know, the clash of civilizations and stuff like this. But it remains there. And for me, you know, the anti-authoritarian, the anarchist part of things, philosophy and political ideology, it's there, small scale, in co-ops and in you know, in how we organize our movements of protest or whatever, and small geographical locations like here. I mean, it's not anarchist here, but it's certainly anti-authoritarian and participatory democracy in Chiapas or in Oaxaca, down in Brazil with the Semterra, the Landless Movement, or in a variety of places. The thing is, though, no, it's tiny and it's not making any effect, but it's an idea and it's a vision of how it could be. And that's important, because in these dark times we need a vision. We need a way to take us out of this. I'm just where I live at the moment in San Cristobal in Chiapas, there's this huge upsurge in activity of the evangelical churches. These people, I mean, these right-wing evangelical churches are really mobilizing in all over Latin America at the moment. And people are flocking to them. And why? Why? I mean, they're flocking to them like they used to flock to the Liberation Church in the 80s. But now it's these right-wing evangelical churches. And what is it about their ideology or whatever that people go there? And it's not. It's because they're organizing soup kitchens, they're helping single mothers, they're there in the community and they're doing a lot of this type of work, you know? And it kind of like, it reminds me of when I read about the Black Panthers in California or on the East Coast at the end of the 60s, you know? They're doing this kind of community organizing that people need, that people want. And it's not just about ideology, about ideas and about concepts and about how we organize. It's like real bread and butter issues. So the anarchist movement or the anti-authoritarian movement these days, no, we haven't arrived at that. We haven't got the resources or the people. We're nowhere near that, beginning to organize within the communities. And that's where the key lies, you know, with the people.
Right.
Nowhere near it. I mean, I don't know what the situation is in L.A., but I can't imagine it's too hopeful.
Well, it kind of brings me to my next question, which is, you know, we are living in a very reactionary state. It's very xenophobic, attack on immigrants, people coming over the border from Central and South America, and, of course, this propaganda war, the thing called the War on Terror, to justify more, you know, imperial state violence. And it's a sad, very sad state of affairs. And you know, it brings me to one part of your book called the Chicken Bus Diaries. And I want to read a quote from it. You say, "I leave Chiapas early one morning in December and cross the border into Guatemala. The border zone is typically hectic." Excuse me. "And all the traffic is going one way north on the long road to the USA. It is disconcerting to enter a country that everybody else seems to be in a hurry to abandon. This river of Central Americans, some with the most paltry of luggage, is migrating with some urgency to the belly of the beast. Most will not make it. They will fall victim to robbers, Mexican immigration, tricksters, poleros, or the U.S. Border Patrol. Some will perish in the Arizona desert. Some will drown crossing the Rio Grande. It's a grim testimony to the desperate state of the homes they are departing, that they are facing such risks for the joy of some temporary menial job in a hostile, racist environment within a nation of curiously inward-looking and psychologically damaged people, half of whom actually voted for the Dark Prince of Empire himself, Bush Jr."
Oh, dear.
And it's true. And, you know, when I read that line, curiously inward-looking and psychologically damaged people, you know, I couldn't help but think that you're right. And it's the effects of propaganda in this country are so devastating.
Yeah.
The effects of being so singular and so insular.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a condition, and I think a lot of Americans don't even recognize it. Even ones, you know, it's in us. And reading your voice from somebody who's, you know, from a different place and experiencing, you know, seeing the sea of people coming to this country, and you have actually one story about somebody who said they never wanted to come back. You know, they spent time in Miami, I think, and you know, and you know, you tell the stories of some of these people. But what is driving the people? I mean, I guess I know the answer to the question of what's driving the people north, but maybe tell us a little story about some of these people.
Well, first of all, it's interesting you bring this up because it made me think, it reminds me of May 1st in the U.S. this year, where I happened to be in New York. And, I mean, maybe you were in L.A. at the time, and you had these migration marches, which were remarkable. So I'm walking down Broadway in New York, and there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, who knows, I don't know, a huge, biggest march I've ever seen in New York, well, apart from the RNC, 2003. And it's a constituency that didn't exist before May the 1st, 2006, no?
Yeah.
It's like this invisible clandestine constituency, political constituency that suddenly emerged. It gave me great hope. I said, oh my God, look at this sea of migrants, you know, and they're out there and they're organizing. Okay, the demands are, you know, fall short of any type of radical demands, just demand for recognition, basically. But I thought it was incredible. I thought this came from nowhere. This is like an invisible constituency that just says, yeah, basta, here we are. And I'm walking down Broadway, and I'm surrounded by people from Chiapas. All these people, you know, from Oaxaca and from Chiapas, from Puebla, from all these places, indigenous people. And it was an incredible feeling. And I thought, oh, my God, the Zapatistas have taken Broadway. But it wasn't quite. So the curiously inward-looking idea, well, notion of people within the U.S., it comes from around that time. I was asking all the people, I was working in New York at the time, I was just asking regular people around me in the bar, you know, what they thought of this migrants march. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, New York's meant to be liberal. I'm in a bar, you know, kind of liberal bar. And all these people working there, and all these people are like, oh, we don't like it. You know, they're foreigners, they shouldn't be protesting. They, you know, they should be just glad to be here earning money and, you know, send it back to their people in Latin America or whatever. And they shouldn't be causing trouble. They've no right. And all these people I was talking to were like second or third or fourth generation migrants, usually from Europe. And they didn't see the irony in that, you know, as they were condemning these migrants for being ungrateful to the hand that feeds them, that sort of stuff. So this was a real blow, you know, people who, you're thinking just regular folks who would have enlightened ideas, and no, you scratch the surface and they don't like these foreign people coming, protesting. It's okay when they're working in the kitchens, but not when they're in the street.
That's right.
So, that phrase is borrowed from Arundhati Roy, who wrote it in one of her essays about the U.S., about the empire.
Yeah, it's a good phrase, and we live in a culture of fear in this country, and there's billions of dollars spent to make sure that we do,
mm-hmm.
And it's hard to break out of it, and it takes a lot of effort. As Chomsky would say, it's intellectual self-defense.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was struck by was the Rainbow Gathering, and one of the things you say, which I'm just going to read again from your book, because I like to read from your book.
You're a wonderful reader.
Thank you.
I'm going to take you on tour.
Okay. Excellent. I look forward to it. The Munich yuppies are preparing coffee and smoking joints, and one of them says to me, "Peace and love, brother." And I don't think so. Yuppies and love don't go. And this is the crux. The illusion of peace and love, of international communities, of utopian spaces created outside of society, it can only end in a Jim Jones-style massacre or dissolution. And it's not enough. It's never enough. Rainbow gatherings are all right for your holidays, but one more push, idealists, if you want to be revolutionaries. And that struck me because I think, you know, a lot of people need to be pushed a little bit farther or want to be pushed a little bit farther.
Yeah.
What was your experience at the Rainbow Gathering?
Well, I mean, it's one of these typical escapist phenomenons, you know, where people who are not happy, who are against the system as such, and they begin organizing, but, you know, only to have a good time, only to enjoy themselves, self-gratification. And that's the problem, you know. You have to go further. It was interesting, you know. I was in the U.S. recently on a book tour, and just the response of the people. Now, of course, the people who are coming to these alternative bookstores to listen to some Irish pirate reading his book are going to be, you know, a very special section of the community, you know. They're going to be the radical progressive anarchists, whatever. But it was amazing to hear them to talk and how they organized, despite what you're talking about, the fear. And, you know, the United States is like Europe as well. It's like this, you can rebel enough, you can take drugs, and you can, you know, you can have a counter-culture revolution, but you can't have a political revolution. So these were the people who were organizing for the political revolution, you know. And they're everywhere, and they're all across the country. There's like so many people organizing. But of course, this climate of fear, this huge budget that the Pentagon has, and the force of repression, And I had to admire them, you know. They're in the belly of the beast, and they're fighting, and they're organizing. And it's so difficult, you know. And that's where hope lies. It's tiny, you know, but that's where hope lies. But Croatia? That's another thing altogether.
It was exactly that. It's really wonderful to hear you articulate that it's the hope in these small groups of people that continue to struggle,
yeah,
and try to make something a little bit better for people around them.
Mm-hmm.
And their numbers are small, and you know, right now there is a very oppressive state apparatus in place. And mm-hmm. you may or may not be aware, but I'm sure you are, there's a lot of laws that have been changed in this country that allows
yeah.
the president to declare a citizen an enemy combatant.
Yeah.
There are Halliburton's building special containment facilities for who knows what on, you know, in the U.S. And of course, we saw what happened with Katrina last year, and the
yeah.
anniversary was here. Last week, and you know, so it's a very oppressive environment, and I think a lot of people who aren't organizing but feel the pressure tend to sort of live in a world of self gratification, and it's easy to understand why that is.
Yeah. But,
and I think the Rainbow Gathering is sort of, and that chapter in particular was. I think you articulated it very well of what you were feeling, and that last paragraph I just read sort of, you know, nailed it down for me.
Yeah. That said, you know, I think these people could be on board, you know, if there was a certain amount of consciousness, raising awareness, you know, within these communities. I think they're almost there, you know. I mean, it's, on one hand, things like the Rainbow Gathering, which is in the U.S. as well, it's all over the world, is really has got radical elements, but it just falls short. And now there are people there who could, you know, mobilize this constituency towards getting involved politically as well. But then you're introducing a whole new level of danger. That said, you know, the Rainbow Gathering in Russia a few years ago was attacked by, like, the military forces. They came in. These people are just sitting around with their bongo drums singing in a field in Russia, and tanks were sent in, and they're all locked up. So, you know, they're taking blows, too, as well. They're facing repression. I have a critique, but ultimately we're on, you know, there's this side, and then there's the other side.
Right, no, definitely. One of the other places that you went to was Kurdistan, and ended up in a very scary situation in the bottom of a basement, and you describe it vividly, and sort of felt what probably a lot of people who were murdered by the Turkish state had gone through, and that was, it was almost like I felt the fear or the tension just reading the chapter.
Yeah.
One of the things you write about, which I think is important to discuss the issue, is the hierarchical structures and how they sort of play out and affect these movements. You write, all the shortcomings of a revolutionary movement plagued by a leadership cult, an implacable hierarchical structure became apparent. In a history similar to Peru's Sendero Luminoso, the Kurdistan Workers' Party collapsed once their leader had been captured.
Yeah.
But let's talk about that, because you saw this in many places, and in Nicaragua, in
yeah.
Brazil with the PT, and in Kurdistan.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two issues here. First of all, and when you began talking about how the Turkish police were torturing the Kurdish militants who were fighting for national liberation, torture is really important, because as soon as you begin to threaten the state, the kid gloves come off and they start torturing. I mean, this is the lesson we learn from any radical movement anywhere in the world.
And it's happening now.
It's happening now, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so blatant now. It's as bad as it's ever been, you know. It's worse. The thing is, though, revolutionary movements, when they're faced with these type of repressive responses from the state, generally grow more hierarchical, secretive, clandestine, with less decision, less participatory democracy. They close down, they become secret because they have to, because the stakes have risen so high. So this falls into the state's, you know, arsenal of tactics and strategy to destroy the positive democratic participatory democracy leanings of radical movements. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So as soon as they start getting really hard, like they are at the moment, I mean, with the green scare and everything in the U.S., they're basically, you know, they're making it impossible to organize, and so you have to go underground, you know, if you're seriously threatening the interests of the state. I mean, in Ireland, the levels of torture in the 70s and 80s against the IRA and the Republican community in general, like those who were resisting British imperialism and the British occupation, was astonishing. You know, people were being thrown out of helicopters and things. So it's always been there. I mean, at the moment, it's an issue at the moment. The response in terms of authoritarianism within the movements, how do you deal with that? I don't know. I mean, if you in Oaxaca, what they're doing at the moment is there's paramilitary squads going around at night. They're kidnapping people. They're disappearing people, leaders from the movement, who are out there, who are in the streets, who are, like, you know, very public figures, leading teachers or whatever. They're being kidnapped in the night, taken away and disappeared. There's been like a half a dozen deaths in the last month. So how does the movement respond to that? You want to be open. You want to be really, you know, include everybody in the decision-making process. But as soon as anybody gets any prominence by talking in public or whatever, they become a target for these right-wing forces. So there's a contradiction there. There's like this ambivalence between opening up the radical movements and then keeping them clandestine or secret, you know. And this is one of the issues throughout the book.
Is it hopelessly naive to even, you know, think that you can organize in a non-hierarchical manner under this kind of repression?
You know, I'm reading John Ross's book. Do you know John Ross? He's a Mexican-based gringo journalist, called Murdered by Capitalism. And he talks about, you know, this huge movement in the U.S., the trade union movement, the Wobblies, the workers' movement, the labor movement 100 years ago. And it was open, and everybody was out there speaking in public, and they were always getting arrested and everything, and ultimately they had to go underground because they were destroyed by the repressive forces as well. Have we learned any of the lessons of history? I don't know. I mean, either you get burnt out or you get locked up if you're part of, you know, a really radical movement. In the U.S., it's so small, it's just like ignored. So you just get no, you know, you don't have an impact, so they kind of ignore you. That's changing now, of course, with the war on everybody in the U.S. at the moment. So no, I don't. Maybe it's hopelessly naive to think that you can openly change things, but you just have to continue in that way because the other direction is heading towards these authoritarian, clandestine structures that have been shown to fail throughout history.
Right, right. And, you know, somewhere in between, it who knows? You know, the other thing is that I think that people in this country, they hear about torture in Guantanamo and in Iraq, and it is becoming, you know, the gloves are off. I mean, it's clearly the gloves are off by the state, and they're just, you know, it's very frightening because I don't see how this is going to slow down.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that is really important also in your book, is that you talk about what the brutal violence that people have to suffer under, and I think a lot of people don't really realize how violent the state can be when it is threatened and what it can do to people. And, you know, I'm certainly within the community of people who listen to this radio station and indie media, and they've heard it and they know about it. But
you've been down here in Chiapas, right?
Yeah.
So I think, and a lot of people have passed through on their travels, and it's fairly close, you know. But what happened in Atenco, and as I say, there is a fear here in Chiapas that the Atenco solution, the police brutality that happened there, will happen here. And what you have is a very tranquil tourist town where everybody goes around their business, just living their lives normally, like they did in Atenco. And then suddenly there's like 4,000 cops surrounding you, breaking down doors, dragging people out. And this is a reality. This could happen. This could happen, you know, within the next couple of months or a couple of weeks. Who knows? I mean, I don't mean to fearmonger, but the reality is that the brutality of the state, the mask is off, the kid gloves are off, and now we live in perilous times.
Yeah.
So what you have to do is just organize and be ready and resist, you know, rather than just get filled with fear. I mean, when the Zapatistas called a red alert this time last year, and it seemed like they were going to go back to the armed struggle, which seemed like an insane move considering the time and place. But the word here in Chiapas was, okay, the Zapatistas are considering going back to armed struggle like they did in 94, rising up, or else they're going to go wholly political and leave the arms behind. So many people were just packing up and leaving. You know, there was general fear. It was incredible. People were like panic buying, going down to the supermarket and buying lots of rice or whatever. And a lot of people were just like getting out of here. So this fear is all prevalent, but that's not the response to critical situations. The response is to, you know, to get together and talk to all the people around you, your neighbors, your community, and begin organizing. What are we going to do if things get really bad?
Right. I want to remind listeners that I am speaking with Raymer Ryan, author of Clandestines, the Pirate Journals of an Irish Exile, published by AK Press. You are listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. And this is Indie Media On Air, and I'm Chris Burnett. I want to read another quote from your book, and it sort of is a nod to the future and thinking about the future and kind of what we were talking about. When you don't have any options, you have to organize. You write, "I think the history of this era, basically the 90s, will be written with a grudging nod to the anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist movements that emerged after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the demise of the communist influence on global struggle. Here and amongst the wider protest movement, hope was nourished despite the official proclamation announcing the, quote, end of history, unquote, and the struggle for a better world was renewed. And what was life like below deck in the engine room and the crew's mess on this ship of resistance? These are the stories that need to be told, too. How do we live side by side? How do we treat each other? From where springs solidarity and mutual aid? Where is freedom and how best to overcome our despair? I'm not sure, but I think I know where to look for the answers." Where's that?
I'm not sure. You know, the process of writing this book, I was really against it from the very start because I thought, it's so just, I mean, how dare I step back from the struggle and start writing, take a year out or whatever and start writing all this stuff about the all the places I've been and the struggles that I've been privileged to witness and everything. And it seemed like, why write? You know, things are too critical. We can't be wasting time just sitting back to write. But I was wrong, you know. I mean, in these dark times, in this really heavy situation, we have to remember. We have to remember past struggles. We have to, like, fight against amnesia. We have to remember that there is hope. And so the process of remembering all these different places where I'd been and the people I'd met and the inspiration that I'd felt had to go on the page. And then, so the book came out 3 months ago and, you know, I wasn't really thinking much about it, just that there'd be much of a response, but I put my email address at the back of the book. And every day, Chris, people are writing and saying, you know, and telling me little stories about their struggle or about what's happening in their locality, you know, whether it's in, it's all English-speaking nations, of course, so it's usually England or Ireland or the US. And it's been really inspiring, you know. People have read it and said, well, you know, it reminds me of this moment when people came together here, or it inspires me to do this or to get involved in everything. And so, you know, there's a receptive audience out there, and things like this, even writing, even documentaries, indie media, everything's really important. Okay, because at this moment, you know, we're not, it's a period of rollback. You know, we're not in a great movement that's growing and threatening the state or anything. But just keeping that idea alive and the vision alive, I think, is an important thing to do at this time. So I don't know if that answers the question.
It does answer. No, it really does. You were fortunate enough to be around in Berlin during the fall of the wall.
Yeah.
And I don't want to spend too much time on that because there's we don't have much more time actually. And I want to wrap this up with some comments about Mexico.
Okay.
But I just want to let people know that there's some amazing stories in the book about the Berlin Wall and crossing it over and sort of being in between, crushed between two empires, mm-hmm. you know, the West and the East at the time. And it's great stuff. But in our last few minutes, and I do want to say this has been so enjoyable to have this conversation with you. It's a pleasure. And I think you're right about your analysis of people's response. Are you, you know, not right about it, you know, you're articulating. I think that's the effect that I had, that it had on me, and really enjoyed reading it, and I'm glad that you did write it. And you quote Edward Galeano's essay in defense of the word, and I think you're right about that. Our writing is informed by a desire to make contact so that readers may become involved with words that come to us from them, and that return to them as hope and prophecy. That's great.
Yes, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy because the impact or the response I'm having from my little book that I didn't think people would really pick up much has been exactly that, you know. People have been saying it's given them a little bit of hope. So that's been great.
Yeah.
That's been really important. But of course, now to move on, because there's not a moment to lose.
Yeah.
As I'm speaking today in Mexico, I mean, we've got basically a revolutionary, insurrectionary situation. In Mexico City, it's really absurd. It's like Alice in Wonderland. It's the world turned upside down. The opposition candidate is mobilizing, you know, who's been cheated out of the elections through this fraud, this obvious fraud of the state. And he's using the tactics, radical tactics, direct action. They're blocking the streets. They're doing all sorts of really imaginative direct action in it, all over the country, the opposition party, the PRD, the Party for Democratic Revolution. And yet, what they're fighting for is they want their guy to be president. You know, it's kind of, so they're, AMLO, the López Obrador, the candidate himself, is calling for a revolution, an institutional revolution. In Oaxaca, they're calling for a revolution, an institutional revolution, a change in the Constitution. So you've got all these forces coming together. You know, a kind of reformist force for change gathered around the electoral politics of López Obrador. And then these revolutionaries in Oaxaca and Chiapas and Guerrero, all around Mexico, calling for revolutionary change in society. But their common goal is a change in the Constitution. And that's what the Zapatistas are calling for with the other campaign as well, which is the anti-electoral campaign, which we didn't get onto today, but it's another thing going on here. So it's really interesting. It's a really dynamic moment in Mexican history. And as I say, the storm clouds gathering here in Chiapas as we speak. And President Fox is going to address the nation today. And the citizens are laying siege on him, you know. He's got his presidential guard. It's like Chile in the dictatorship or something. He's got his presidential guard surrounding Congress. They've got huge barriers. It's like the WTO meeting in Cancun or something, you know, and the people are just like holding the place siege. And what's going to happen? It could go either way.
Well, that's a great place to leave it off as the struggle continues.
Right.
You know?
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much, Chris.
Well, Raymer, thank you very much for joining us today on Indie Media On Air. And I want to mention the book again by Raymer Ryan, Clandestines, The Pirate Journals of an Irish Exile, is available from AK Press. If you go to akpress.org, you can find it. And it's been a pleasure. I loved your book, and I hope we can chat again in the future.
Okay, thank you very much. very much, Chris.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.